From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Photographer Joel Meyerowitz has been spending every day at Ground Zero, documenting the hellish landscape and the slow process of removing the remains of the Twin Towers. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Meyerowitz about this work. The World Trade Center had a special significance for him. For 15 years, he photographed the towers from his studio window. In fact, he was preparing an exhibit of those photos when the World Trade Center was attacked. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from country singer George Jones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Officials say tests confirm the presence of anthrax at an off-site mail screening facility for the White House. Presidential spokesman Ari Fleischer said today the facility is at a military installation several miles from the White House. Fleischer says it's been closed for further testing and adds that all environmental tests at the White House itself have come back negative. Fleischer says that all employees at the site are being tested for exposure, as were mail workers in the White House complex itself. Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson said today the government is changing its approach to potential anthrax contamination. NPR's Joanne Silberner has this report.
After a Senate staffer opened a letter contaminated with anthrax spores, government officials began environmental testing at the post office that handles the Capitol's mail. But postal workers weren't put on preventive antibiotics until one of the workers got sick. Secretary Thompson said today that the next time there's a suspect letter, the government will act immediately.
We're going to get there, test the facility, and make the appropriate treatment available to those who may have been exposed. We're going to act quickly, and if need be, let the science catch up to our actions.
Thompson spoke at a House of Representatives hearing held at the Department of Health and Human Services because buildings belonging to the House are still being checked for bacterial contamination. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
There are more reported casualties in the war against terrorism in Afghanistan, but it is unclear how many people may have been killed. NPR's John Burnett is in Peshawar, Pakistan.
The Pentagon announced today that a misguided bomb landed in a field next to an elderly home outside the western Afghan city of Herat. The guidance system reportedly malfunctioned. There's no information on whether anyone died, but if so, the Pentagon spokesperson said the United States regrets the loss of life. The announcement happened too late at night, Afghan time, for the Taliban to capitalize on it. In a separate incident, a United Nations agency official said that a U.S. projectile struck a military hospital inside a military garrison in Herat. The Taliban claimed the bomb killed 100 people, including patients and staff, but that figure could not be verified. Despite the Taliban's claim of U.S. genocide, aid agencies with staff in Afghanistan say that U.S. bombs have generally hit their targets, which are military, and that accidental deaths have been relatively low. John Burnett, NPR News, Peshawar, Pakistan.
U.S. military officials said today U.S. warplanes attacked Taliban front lines and a stronghold linked to Osama bin Laden. They say the attacks were designed to soften Taliban positions for the expected advance of the Northern Alliance, but the Taliban forces reportedly held their ground, launching rockets and mortars toward the Alliance forces. Elsewhere, defense officials say American warplanes set fire to critical Taliban oil supplies in Kandahar. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 37 points. The Nasdaq closed down 3. You're listening to NPR News. The Irish Republican Army today began to disarm. The unprecedented step could lead to the end of decades of bloodshed and boost Northern Ireland's shaky peace process. British Prime Minister Tony Blair called it a move of fundamental significance. Pro-British Unionist leader David Trimble said he wants his party to rejoin the ruling coalition. It was Trimble's resignation as Northern Ireland's first minister that precipitated the current crisis in July. The United States today again pressed Israel to withdraw its forces from Palestinian-controlled areas of the West Bank. President Bush and Secretary of State Colin Powell discussed the issue with Israel's Foreign Minister Shimon Peres. Peres is visiting Washington. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Israeli forces occupied 6 Palestinian cities following last week's murder of an Israeli cabinet minister by Palestinian gunmen. After meetings with President Bush and Secretary of State Powell, Foreign Minister Peres said Israel will withdraw its forces once Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat arrests those responsible for the murder and takes steps to prevent attacks on Israelis. Peres downplayed any disagreement with the U.S., but State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the Israeli military should pull out now.
Its presence there contributes to an escalation in violence and should be withdrawn immediately.
The U.S. is appealing for calm in the Mideast as it seeks to strengthen its international coalition against terrorism. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
Russia's top prosecutor and a team of investigators aboard the now-raised Kursk submarine. They walked onto the deck today hoping to find some clues about what caused it to explode and sink. The team observed a moment of silence before stepping onto the submarine. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Photographer Joel Marowitz has been spending his days at Ground Zero, documenting the hellish landscape where the World Trade Center used to be and the slow process of removing the remains. He will give the photos to the Museum of the City of New York. The Twin Towers had a personal significance for Marowitz. He has a series of photos of the towers and the Manhattan skyline that he took from his studio window over the course of 15 years. Several of those pictures were recently published in The New Yorker. They will be on exhibit at the Ariel Marowitz Gallery in Manhattan beginning November 1st. Joel Marowitz is best known for his series of photos, Cape Cod Light. He was on the Cape September 11th. He got back to New York about 5 days later. It took him several more days to get permission to enter Ground Zero. I asked him what it was like to watch the TV images of the planes crashing into the towers he had gazed at and photographed for so many years.
It was even more astonishing to me, I think, because prior to the event, I had been printing these enormous 5-foot prints for the exhibition. So I had been living with World Trade Center pictures in my studio on Cape Cod all summer. They were surrounding me. Every wall was covered with them. And some of the strips were 5 feet high, and there were the World Trade Centers, quite large. So I had been invested in it for that whole summer. And then to have it happen, it was so deeply disturbing and I was in shock, really. And I felt this incredible loss, both from my city, for this structure that I had gazed on, repeatedly over all that time. I just wanted to come back and help or be involved in some way.
When did you first get to Ground Zero?
About, 6 days later. And, of course, like everybody else, I was trapped outside. They already had erected a fence, and there was no getting in unless you had a pass. And, you feel helpless at a moment like that. You want to give something or do something or record something, and I couldn't. And, in fact, that's what motivated me to action finally.
Well, you managed to get a special permit to take pictures at Ground Zero. What did you get and how did you get it?
Well, I'll step back for a moment because what happened was one of those consciousness awakening moments that happens periodically. One would wish for it every day, but in this case, it's every few years. I stood there as an innocent bystander and I raised my camera. I was probably 5 blocks away from the first building. And as I raised my camera just to look through it, a policewoman behind me said, "Hey, put that camera down." And I said, "Why?" I said, "You can hardly see anything. I'm just a citizen standing on a public street." She said, "No photographs. This is a crime scene." I said, "Well, suppose I'm a member of the press." And I reached inside for my press pass. And she said, "Oh, press over there, a half a block further away and behind a cordon." And I said, "Well, what happens to the press?" And she said, "Well, they'll let you in if they think it's a photo op. And I was so enraged. I thought, if there are no photographs, then there's no history. And an event like this needs a history. Every major event in the last 150 years has had some photographic record. And I thought, the day of, I mean, the whole world saw it. The cameras were everywhere. But in the aftermath, that there would be no record seemed to me a crime. And I felt that instant connection to my goal, in a way. I'm going to make the record. And then I set about doing it.
Now, you're best known for your series of photos of Cape Cod and of Cape Cod light, of how beautiful the light is there and how it changes. Did you have to, readjust yourself both psychologically and artistically to now be taking photographs basically in hell?
Mm-hmm. Not exactly. I mean, I am a New Yorker, born here, and I was a street photographer first. So life on the streets, the gritty, rough, unexpected quality of life is part of my earlier training. And the quality of New York light, that splinteringly sharp, edgy, brilliant light, is something I thrive on. So in some sense, I had to adjust to places like Cape Cod in order to understand the softness and subtlety of the light there. So in a way, I've been educated on the streets, but I learned another asset of observation from being on the Cape. And I think coming to Ground Zero, when you're looking at 110 stories of steel, because, you know, what's astonishing about the location is that there are no rocks. There is no concrete left. The concrete was vaporized into those clouds. What fell was 210 stories of churning metal, spiraling and rotating and grinding its way down. And when you come to the site the first time and see what 110 stories of plumbing and cables and I-beams only wiring and metal looks like, it eats your eyes. It's so breathtaking. You almost cannot comprehend it. And I think out of that kind of awe, the tragedy and the awe and the smell and the darkness of it and the vastness of it, even though it's in a 16-acre zone, it seems both vast when you first see it and then somewhat circumscribed, like a little piazza in a city when you get to know it well. It has this funny elastic way or accordion-like way of opening and closing on you.
Are there places that you got into that maybe weren't the safest places to go, but you felt you needed to see what it looked like?
Yes. Right from the beginning, I was fortunate enough to bump into a squad, a police squad of bomb and rescue squad. And they sort of adopted me. I don't know, we hit it off. One of those ways that you have a kind of comradeship in a war zone, in a way. And these guys immediately said, hey, you want to come with us? We'll take you to the top of this building. We'll take you into these offices. We'll take you down there. And so I was shepherded through the maze of these places and was able to make some really astonishing overview photographs right at the beginning. And now as I'm there on a daily basis, it's shrunken considerably. I mean, they must have removed at least 30 to 40% of it already in 1 month.
Can you describe one of the places that the bomb squad took you that you wouldn't have gotten to on your own and what the view was from there?
They took me on the night of the 24th of September up into the World Financial Center. There's a low building underneath one of the skyscrapers, and they took me through this lobby that was just encrusted in dust. All the powder that the concrete turned into infiltrated every office building in the vicinity. And it was inches deep of dust everywhere. And we went in this building and we climbed 9 flights of stairs, zigzagging in between stairwells and crossing through office areas to get to other stairwells to get upstairs. And in every place that we passed, you could see the record of flight, which was, in some way, what it reminded me of was Pompeii. When you go to Pompeii and you see what happened when the lava came down and stopped people in the ordinariness of their lives. You know, now all is revealed in some way. And this dust encrusting everything showed you, you know, books that were open and wallets left on desks and people's possessions, their coats, whatever they left behind when they fled was all there, encrusted in this, entombed in this dust. They finally took me out onto the roof of the building so that I could, in a sense, have a panoramic sweep of the whole of the disaster. This building was opposite the South Tower. So you could look into that and then slightly north into everything else. The roof itself was littered in about a foot deep of papers and chairs and pieces of metal that had flown off of the World Trade Center. The cladding, the aluminum cladding, went flying through the air and wound up in these ribbon masses. Venetian blinds and curtains and I came across, it was a bottle of some mineral water, and it was standing upright. I mean, and where did it come from? It must have flown out of some window and landed vertical in this mass. And wiring everywhere and keyboards to things, all on the roof of the building. It was a record. It was just a record. But when I got to the edge and I looked down, it was lit as if by stadium lighting. So you could see the masses of metal just dripping over every structure that was there was this spaghetti-like, bird's nest-like, swamp-like mess of wiring and metal. And I tell you, it takes your breath away. You almost cannot comprehend the vastness of the destruction until you're standing face to face with it and see this drapery everywhere.
Have you stumbled on scenes that you almost wish you hadn't, things that you maybe didn't even feel like you could photograph? For instance, of remains of bodies?
No, I haven't. And in fact, discretion is important there. I think one of the reasons that the press was banned from this site was severalfold. One was that I think the crime scene quality meant that they didn't want the press messing it up in some way if the press were to move objects around or change things as they sometimes feel is their privilege. They also were fearful that the press's aggressiveness might in some way injure the sacred quality that the firemen and policemen felt about their fallen comrades. They didn't want morgue photographs or body part photographs. And to that extent, I'm not interested in that. When I see a cluster of firemen move in an area and start raking with hand rakes, you know that they found some body part. And for me, I just stay away from that. You know, maybe I photograph from afar so that the story is, oh, that's what it looked like from there, but I don't need to go over and look at it. I think also the incredibly dangerous quality of the site itself was one of the reasons the city held back. When I first went in on, 10 days afterwards, the ground was like walking in a field of swords. Everywhere you stepped, metal was sticking up from the ground, and you had to pick your way so carefully. And things were, I mean, bits of I-beams, rebar, shards of tables and desks, and aluminum everywhere, and everything was from 2 inches high to 2 feet high, and you had to be careful. There were first aid stations all over the place for people who would get sideswiped. You know, you turn around carelessly, and suddenly you're bleeding because a big gash has been taken out of your leg. So they didn't want hundreds of press photographers running around injuring themselves.
My guest is photographer Joel Meyerowitz. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is photographer Joel Meyerowitz. For the past month, he's been taking pictures at Ground Zero. You've been very interested in light through your career as a photographer, whether it's Cape Cod light or Manhattan light. What has the quality of light been like at Ground Zero, and how have you seen that change as the cleanup has advanced?
Well, you know, New York at this time of year has that edgy, brilliant light, and so the space where the event occurred has been cleared out now into this huge plaza. And what is astonishing about the light, if we can go that way, is that the pile is still burning. You know, more than a month later, it's still on fire deep in the bowels of the pile. So the air is always filled with smoke. And the smoke rises like a scrim on a stage, and it layers itself over the backdrop of New York looking east, where you have the Woolworth Building and a number of other more modern towers. So towards the end of the day, in the late afternoon, the sun comes around and it paints all of those buildings pink, and the haze is pink. And many of the buildings behind where the center stood are covered in red drapery. Red, I don't know why they chose red. They could have chosen black just as easily or green, but they're covered in these huge red filmy drapes. So you have these monumental structures in red, now illuminated by red and gold light with smoke billowing. And in the midst of it, these machines, dozens of huge grabbers and earth movers and cranes. It's a forest of machinery. It is a set from the most, you know, hellish opera that you could possibly imagine, and yet it's beautiful. I mean, and you ask yourself, how can that be? How can it be both horrifying and beautiful at the same time? How can one accept that or grasp it or embrace it in some way? And for me personally, it raises the issue of what kind of aesthetic do you use to deal with this kind of beauty horror?
Yeah, tell us more about what you've been thinking on in that.
Well, I think for an artist, it's important to find a form that expresses the content in some way. So do I make, you know, eloquent, tasty photographs about light, or do I try to make photographs that remove any aesthetic expression from my point of view and just witness? And I think for the most part, I've been trying to get out of the ultimate viewer's way and just make searingly etched records of the enormity of the devastation. And should it be colored pink at any moment? Well, that's the color of the light that was there. But try to stay focused and bear down on the complexity and the agitated quality of the life in front of you, and make an image that uses that as energy in a way. And it is it's difficult, I have to say.
Why are you using a very old, large wooden camera instead of a more high-tech, up-to-date, smaller, more portable one?
I'm using an old wooden 8x10-inch Deerdorf camera because the acuity of its description matches the thing itself, so that when the people in the future look at these photographs, the power of every single thing that was there will be rendered as it was. And it, in a sense, it will allow the viewer to have the visceral reaction when they stand in front of it. I envision some of these pictures 10 feet across, so that someone, you know, in a museum setting, you could see it that way, and you could witness it in a way that you can't see it on television when it's 17 inches or something like that. But to be able to stand in front of the, you know, the veritable thing, in a way, is what I'm trying to do, to allow you to have it unfiltered by photographic grain, unmodified by anything technical, but just to be there as if it was the thing itself.
So it's easier to get a larger print with this camera than it would be, say, with a digital camera?
Yes. Well, if you picture, when you hold a 35-millimeter slide up, it's 1 inch by, and you know, 3/4, let's say. My piece of film is 8 inches by 10 inches. So it's 80 times the size of a 35-millimeter. There is no grain. There is nothing between you and the subject. I mean, it's as exquisite and sublime as it could possibly be. It's airless. It's pure description in photographic terms. I mean, after all, it is three dimensions compressed into two, but it's probably the most objective way of making a photograph.
Photographer Joel Meyerowitz, he'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From PBS, this week Frontline follows the trail of a convicted terrorist, from his motives to his methods. Local times may vary. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with photographer Joel Meyerowitz about documenting Ground Zero. And Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by country music star George Jones. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with photographer Joel Marowitz. For the past month, he's been spending every day at Ground Zero, documenting the remains of the World Trade Center and the cleanup process. Few photographers have had access to what he's seeing. He has a special permit to take pictures at Ground Zero. He will give his photos to the Museum of the City of New York. For 15 years, Marowitz took pictures of the World Trade Center and the skyline from his studio window. Several of those pictures were published in The New Yorker. An exhibit of those photos opens November 1st at the Ariel Marowitz Gallery in Manhattan. When the World Trade Center was first being built, a lot of people thought, well, it's really big, it's really tall, but it's not very interesting looking. It's not an interesting piece of architecture. Did you ever feel that way about it, and did your feelings change over time?
Yeah, I felt when they were first going up, there was a kind of monumental ordinariness to them.
Yeah,
and of course, over the years, when I watched them glazed and pickled and mottled and sun spattered, and they began to act the way things in nature act. So they warmed my heart more. But one time I really came to understand them, I think in an architectural way. I was really on the plaza there years ago, and I was looking up, and it suddenly occurred to me that there were no setbacks. Usually in New York, you have to build straight up, and then at 40 stories you set back, and then you build and you set back until you get to a point. But they had built, I guess, with enough plaza space to allow the architects to build straight up. And it was at that moment that I realized that by giving the city back plaza space and public space, the architects won the right to go straight, that's what made those buildings so remarkable, and that, in fact, their form was the form you need to rise 110 stories straight up, and that there was a linear quality to it, and those architects weren't so dumb or vulgar or any of the things that we accused them of being in the beginning, that they had actually solved the problem in an elegant way. But, you know, it takes time, because there's always the artistic community's resentment of, you know, some intrusion into the skyline. And if you look to the left or to the east, you have the elegance of the old Woolworth building with its polished tiles and all of its Gothic refinery and decorativeness, you know. And so part of you as a city person wishes for some elegance. But I came to find that those buildings were elegant. And even now, in the aftermath, when you stand at Ground Zero, and just this week on Friday, they pulled down, which was a sight to see, they decided to pull down one of the facades, which was about, I would say, 10 or 12 stories high. And they took two of these monstrous earth-moving machines and they put in each one's maw a steel beam. And lashed to the beam was a cable, a steel cable, probably 2 inches or more thick. And they ran it up to the top of this structure. And then the two machines acted like horses, dray horses, at a county fair, you know, when the horses pull a sled of logs, or they're pulling some heavy thing, and how long does it take the dray team to pull it across the field? So these two machines would bend their heads the way horses would bob their heads, and they would pull in tandem on the top of this at the top of this building, and then they would back up on their treads an inch or two. And then they'd raise their heads and they'd pull again. They did this for an hour, and the top of the building would sway a few feet here or there. And by the hour, they had moved it maybe 4 feet off center. they were pulling something that wasn't meant to be pulled down that way. And finally, one of the cables just snapped with a huge boing, you know, and they had to quit for the day. But watching the struggle to pull this piece down made you aware of what a shrieking, horrific scene it must have been to have the building tumble. And, I mean, it just keeps bringing you back, you know, just looking at one piece of the building on the ground, and then you multiply it by the 110 stories, and you have to do the arithmetic, the visual arithmetic, to really have the emotion of what's come down.
Right. How have the workers who you've been photographing, like the firefighters, the rescue workers, how have they been reacting to being photographed as they work?
Well, I think my camera and its age is an asset for me, because everybody immediately sees that it's an old wooden thing. And its connotation is 19th century. So people are curious and fascinated by it. Why would that thing be here? It's not some high-tech digital video camera. And so I generally get sympathetic inquiries. You know, why are you using that? And what are you doing with it? And once the conversation begins, and then I can begin to ask them about their experience, they're more vulnerable and open to being my subject if I choose to make them that.
My guest is photographer Joel Meyerowitz. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is photographer Joel Meyerowitz. For the past month, he's been taking pictures at Ground Zero. What kind of, you know, quote, normal life has begun to develop around Ground Zero? I don't know, people selling food or other things that are just part of this new normal life during the cleanup?
It's a great question, Terry. What's happened down there is that this has become the Forbidden City. It's got chain-link fence around it from Chambers Street down to below, several blocks below the World Trade, the south building of the World Trade Center. Within the confines of this 16-acre space, there were set up initially makeshift tent cities so that you could go in there for first aid. You could get a hot meal from the Salvation Army. You could get a cafeteria-like meal made by, Bully Bakery or Nobu or the chefs from Tribeca Grill. All of these terrific restaurants, which were basically closed down, were letting their staffs and their chefs make meals and sandwiches for the workers. There were tents where you could get goggles and gloves and boots and underwear and sweatshirts. I mean, everything you needed, because your clothes were being torn up and your boots were being melted by the intense heat. There were places for snacks and hot drinks and energy bars and Gatorade and, I mean, all of that stuff. So they were just distributed kind of helter-skelter everywhere. And what's happened now is that the season is changing. And winter is going to come on. And so the makeshift tents, which were made out of blue tarps and, canvases and things like that, have been replaced by more formal tents. And some of those tents are being replaced by trailers, you know, this kind you see at construction sites. So bit by bit, it's solidifying into a city within the city. And the workers who are there, crews of iron workers from Local 1 in Chicago, or guys from Texas, or, I mean, Indians, Mohawk Indians from New York State who have high iron guys. So there are enclaves of people all over the place who have settled in, and you get a sense that they're there for the long haul.
What effect do you think it's having on you to go to Ground Zero every day, to go to what you describe as the Forbidden City every day?
Well, I'd like to answer that by backing off first and describing what I think I'm doing and then talk about the effect. So what I proposed to do for the Museum of the City of New York was build this archive. And what I did was I modeled my idea of the archive on the Farm Security Administration's program during the 30s. The Farm Security Administration sent out more than a dozen photographers to photograph the effects of the Depression. Such photographers as Walker Evans, Margaret Bork White, Dorothea Lange, Russell Lee, and many others. And they produced an archive of 270,000 pictures, which was now in the Library of Congress. The man who headed this up was Roy Stryker, and he created a shooting script that was vast, and it gave all of the photographers things to look at when they were out in the American, cities and landscape where the effects of the Depression were. As soon as I was in the World Trade Center, I thought, oh, I see, here's the contents of this place. Like, what happened to street signs and fire hydrants and lamp posts and light posts and signposts? And what happened to all the storefronts and the signage on the storefronts? And what happened to all the little vest pocket parks and the trees and the malls and then the interiors and the shop interiors? And I began to see the dimensions of the archive that was necessary to record for history what it looked like in the aftermath of this disaster. Not just the buildings that collapsed themselves, but the ripple effect that spread out from the center to the peripheral areas. So I started to sort of describe all of these things, and hopefully, you know, I've been as a one-man team while I'm trying to assemble and fund the rest of the team to do this. I've been doing it on my own and basically funding it on my own because the museum hasn't, you know, responded yet in terms of getting funding in place. And one can't wait. In a moment like this, you must just go ahead and use your own resources to save the evidence. So I've been trying to be everywhere and, in a sense, multitasking. What it's done for me is that every day when I've entered, I've had that same crushing, somewhat sickening feeling of the disaster over again. And truly, when you stand at the foot of the pile and you look at it, and you see the vastness of the metal, and you imagine it coming down, and you put yourself in place, it tears you up. I mean.
So do you go home every night and then develop the photos of the scenes that have been tearing you up every day and then stare at them?
Well, I have them. I have them processed, and I'm working with a lab that does that. Because they're all in color. I only shoot color because from color you can get all the evidence, in a sense. You can see it all. To use black and white would be, it seems to me, inappropriate.
Yeah.
Because the color of destruction has its own meaning, you know, to see how things have changed after a rain, in a way, and how metal rusts is necessary. It's bloody in its own way. But I want to say it's I got kind of choked up there because that's the first response when you return on a daily basis. You're reminded that that happened. But something else is going on that's much more uplifting. And that is that the spirit of Ground Zero is one of reclamation right now. And the workers who are in there, the 1,000 men and women and soldiers and police and firemen and riggers and welders and crane operators, they're making it over. They're cleaning it up. And there's a kind of spirit, a camaraderie, that is the kind of thing we only knew about in stories from World War II. You know, when you get these great stories about people working together, pulling together to do something that was a unified, heroic effort. I feel that when I'm down there. There's a kind of optimism. There's a proliferation of flags everywhere. On every pile, there's a flag. On every basket that's hanging from a 350-foot crane with a couple of welders in it, there's a flag. There are, you know, the locals have put their signage up everywhere. They're like taking the territory with all of its wounds in their arms and embracing it. And I tell you, you could cry just as easily for the American can-do spirit. I mean, it's big.
You were photographing the World Trade Center from your studio window for many years before the attacks. When you look out your studio window now at the view where you used to see the World Trade Center, what do you see?
Well, the question doesn't apply because I gave that view up in 1994, 1995.
Oh.
I gave up the studio. I have been going back to that studio periodically over the years because a publishing company took over my space and they've been, you know, happy to have me come back and photograph from there. So the last photograph I made was on the 8th or 9th of September. I was in New York printing this exhibition. And I went up there on an evening, on a beautiful fall evening, to look at it and see if there was something worth photographing. And I remember it was a pristine evening, no clouds in the sky. In a sense, it was dull because there was nothing happening that was exciting. But it was so beautiful and spare and cloudless. And there was that aura as dusk settled. It was kind of red at the horizon, and it was blue-green in the middle, and it was indigo above. It was the perfect Roy G. Biv spectrum. And I made the picture, and I thought, well, I'll come back in a couple of days. It's always going to be here. I remember thinking it's always going to be here. It was that permanent to me. And then the 11th happened. And it's never going to be there again. And it just shows you should never be complacent about what seems eternal, because it's all changing right in front of us.
Well, Joe Marowitz, thank you so much for talking with us. And I wish you the best of luck with your project of documenting the cleanup at the World Trade Center. Thank you.
You're welcome, Terry. It's been a great privilege to be here. Thanks.
Joe Marowitz will give his photos of Ground Zero to the Museum of the City of New York. His World Trade Center skyline photos from the 80s and 90s will be on exhibit at the Ariel Marowitz Gallery in Manhattan beginning November 1st. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by country music star George Jones. This is Fresh Air.
George Jones has been making hit country records since the 50s. His new collection, called The Rock, Stone Cold Country 2001, finds him working with some younger artists. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it's resulted in one of Jones' best albums in a while.
When you wake up in the morning and you wonder why no one's beside you, where I usually lay, and you think you hear the sound of distant thunder, well, that's just your old rock, just your old rock, a rolling away. I was a rock standing.
The notion of George Jones as a rock, that is, a dependable stand-up guy, would have been a joke 20 years ago. Then, in the throes of a well-publicized drinking problem and general career-long orneriness, he was often referred to as No-Show Jones, a star you couldn't even be sure would show up for a booked concert performance, let alone a man who might provide a loved one with comfort and strength. But times change, and Jones, who's made numerous declarations of his sobriety and who survived a serious 1998 car accident, is now singing with a renewed vigor and crispness.
I've seen rock bottom, and I've sailed to the top. Now I'm somewhere in between. I believe that it's over, but sometimes I'm still blue. There's no place so lonely being half over you. Don't feel much like climbing, 'cause I don't want to fall. Here in the middle, I don't feel much. Accept the fact that we're through. There's no place so lonely being half over you.
There's a prime slab of George. He takes a stately ballad with a woeful pun as its chorus and sings it like he's just experiencing the pain of heartbreak for the first time. Longtime fans will be impressed with the way he's hitting the low notes these days. Known for his clenched jaw nasal wail, Jones, at his 1960s best, used to dive deep for emotional low notes for spine-tingling effects. It was the triumph of a limited pop voice achieving maximum emotional expressiveness. Drinking and smoking for so many years blew out Jones's voice for a while, but on this CD he sounds well-rested and, for such a notoriously insecure great singer, serenely confident.
So many things are on your mind. You look troubled and scared to death. And the chores you missed on your very long list, it won't let you catch your breath. I know we've had some hard times, but I won't let that get in the way. Before you cry tonight and get uptight, there's one thing that I'd like to say. Honey, hush, turn the lights down low. Don't think so hard, leave our cares and woes, and dance with me. Let me lead you across the floor. Honey, hush,
As I suggested earlier, the George Jones on display on The Rock is a chastened carouser. Until now, his greatest hits were almost entirely, unabashedly, and I dare say unconsciously, selfish. He'd apologize to his lover or his spouse, most famously in the duets he used to sing with his now ex-wife Tammy Wynette, for being unfaithful, drunk, mean, or worse. But it was always about him, his sins, his reactions to them, his need for absolution. On The Rock, choosing material from good younger songwriters like Al Anderson, Karen Staley, and Jamie O'Hara, Jones has developed a conscience, and it's done him a world of good.
I didn't cheat, and I didn't lie, so her leaving took me by surprise. Just a note on the table saying we're through. At first I went crazy, so it took me some time, but I finally read between the lines. It's not what I did, it's what I didn't do. I didn't care.
The album title, The Rock, Stone Cold Country 2001, carries a whiff of desperation, as if Jones was frantically waving to us from behind a crowd of wiggly Dixie chicks and macho cowboy-headed 20-something saying, "Hey, I'm still here." In a misguided bid for commercial airplay, the CD also contains a novelty tune duet with Garth Brooks called Beer Run that you'll thank me for sparing you. It's too bad that George Jones seems, 50 years on, to feel the need to come to us begging for an audience. But if ever there was a living legend who benefits from humility, it's George Jones, a fine specimen of newly formed solid rock.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
There's been bridges and there's been walls. There's been times I've been walking tall. I have loved and I have lost. I have lived and I paid the cost. I guess the good Lord made me a man, and I am. I have reaped and I have sowed. I've been blessed like no one I know. I've seen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, How the Heart Grows Wise on the Spiritual Path by Jack Kornfield. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Dr. Peter Piot, Executive Director of UNAIDS, the United Nations agency coordinating the fight against the disease. He also co-discovered the Ebola virus. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.